Rachel Bloom, wearing an even tinier hat this time. Josh Groban and the company of the Great Comet are coming up. Plus, Mark Hamill, Glenn Close, Stephen Colbert. How do you say it? No, that's not it. And Keegan-Michael Key. The Tony Awards, only CBS, no other network.
Okay.
Welcome back to My Little Tonys.
We're here to finish up 2017. It's interesting that this season really divides up very neatly into the two hits and then the two major flops. Like, I don't know if we've seen a season like this.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I can't believe I was trying to put Natasha or, you know, Great Comet in part one. That was just my own bias showing.
I can't remember a show that was as good as Natasha and Pierre that had gotten as bad as a treatment.
I know. Well, should we just get right into it? Without further ado.
Yes.
Okay. Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. Open November 14th, 2016. Closed September 3rd, 2017. After 336 performances. Book, music, and lyrics by Dave Malloy. Directed by Rachel Chavkin. Choreographed by Sam Pinkleton. Adapted from War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And the synopsis is, Natasha is a beautiful ingenue visiting Moscow. Or Moscow, while she waits for her beloved fiancé Andrei to return from war. In a moment of indiscretion, she is seduced by the dashing but already married Anatole, and her position in society is ruined. Her only hope lies in Pierre, the lonely outsider whose love and compassion for Natasha may be the key to her redemption and the renewal of his own soul. So I'm mostly excited that I get to brag about the fact that I have read War and Peace. I don't really get that opportunity.
I'm curious because I've never read it. And, you know, kind of this genesis story of Dave Malloy kind of being, I guess he was on at sea while he and his
yeah.
girlfriend were reading it and corresponding.
Yeah, he was working on a cruise ship.
Which, knowing that life, it's very miserable.
Yeah.
They were reading War and Peace together and corresponding about it.
Yeah, he was very struck by this certain section. The short, I think it's only about 70 pages long. I found that very relatable because when I read it, I really was not interested in the war parts, but I like loved sort of the society soap opera drama.
You love the peace aspect.
I loved the peace, not crazy about the war. That was that's my review of it. So this was right up my alley.
Did you remember this particular section?
I remembered all of the characters pretty much, but I didn't really remember. It was a little bit fuzzy. It had been about 10 years. Actually, it was exactly 10 years at this point because I read it in high school.
Well, it's a complicated Russian novel.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, and I know like this is not everybody's opinion, but like I think this is a great way to adapt this kind of epic story where you like don't run into the problem that I have with Les Mis, where it's like when you're trying to adapts, you know, this huge kind of cumbersome story that has a million characters, like a million different things happening. You kind of are just jumping from like highlight to highlight. And this really, you know, taking a short section, you can really let it breathe in a nice way.
And this wasn't his first turn adapting a piece of classic literature. He had previously done this Beowulf adaptation that I think in spirit was like very similar to this, where, you know, it was kind of like a very conceptual use of the text as a, you know, platform to create music and whatnot.
Yeah, and I think that Dave Malloy is like an important, you know, whether or not, like, I know this show is very polarizing, even amongst the hosts of this show, but like, I think Dave Malloy is like a really important person to exist in like the current sort of ecosystem of musical theater, because he's someone who's really working in like a very experimental kind of avant-garde theater scene. Like, it's kind of, I mean, and we'll get into it, but it really is a fluke that this ever even made it to Broadway. And like talking about the section we read for Dear Evan Hansen, where it was like most musicals start on the producer's desk as opposed to like a writer finding something that really captures their imagination and inspires them, like he's a guy who is really sort of bringing that to the table, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I think more so than any of the other shows this season, I'm surprised that this one made it to Broadway.
And it burned out so spectacularly. spectacularly in a bad way.
Well, I think that, you know, they were even saying, I think this might have been in the Broadway Backstory podcast episode they did on this show, that it was just so expensive, even off Broadway, to do, you know, even with someone like Josh Groban, who has sex and star appeal. But he was wearing
they
like
put
a
him
weird
in the
fat suit.
Yeah.
Which I feel like I didn't read when I was reading all the reviews and press, like no one talks about.
I saw a couple of references to it, but it's very rude because, you know, Dave Mollet wrote the character based on himself, and it's like, we're going to cast, you know, this sexy pop star, and not based on himself, but wrote it for himself to perform, and he like performed it in all the other versions, and they were like, we're going to cast this sexy pop star, but make him wear a fat suit.
I feel like we saw Dave Mollet because Josh
Groban. Did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's the same as sort of Bette and Hello Dolly, where it's like, I don't really care about Josh Groban. No offense, Grobanites. But like, for me, it's way more exciting to see the person who wrote the whole thing, wrote the role for himself, has been playing it for years. I don't really see how that's that different from seeing like Lin-Manuel Miranda in Hamilton. You know, like that's kind of where the magic is for me.
Yeah, especially in a show that I feel like having the actual author as a character in, it creates such a interesting experience, because I think this, like Hamilton, or I don't even know if Hamilton really does this, but I think one of the strengths of this piece to me is that like the point of view is like constantly changing between some of it's narrated, some of it is told from one character's point of view. It really eloquently bops between perspectives and like offers a complicated story in a way that doesn't necessarily make it more complicated, but like adds to the experience.
So as we have mentioned, the show went through a lot of different forms and it started very small. And I pulled some stats from a New York Times article, like talking about sort of the different incarnations of the show that I thought was fun. The show started because Dave Mollet was doing like an artist residency at Ars Nova, and they asked him what he was interested in doing. And this was like a few years after he had read the book, and he was like, well, I want to do this War and Peace thing. So the first Ars Nova production was in an 87-seat theater. They did 39 performances with 16 performers. Then they built a custom tent in like a parking lot in the meatpacking district called Casino. And that was sort of like a dinner theater thing where people were like taking shots and, you know, eating borscht and whatever. So that was 199 seats and 300 performances and 24 performers or 25 performers. And then it moved to American Repertory Theater in Boston, and that was a 500-seat theater, 33 performances, 34 performers, and then it moved to the Imperial Theater, which was 1,200 seats, 43 performers. How many performances was that? We just said 336 performances. So it's interesting, you know, the life of this show has really just been like scaling up and up, although unfortunately not really in performances.
Well, and I think I think it like brings up like an important part of the conversation about the Broadway production, where I feel like what was one of the most like unique things about it was like the theater that it, how the theater it was set in was situated. Where you have like the option to like sit in a banquet table on the stage. The stage was sort of built out into like the first few rows of the orchestra. There was like very little backstage space. And actually, in talking about that, I think in Isherwood's review, he had a really cute thing to say about that. Where to sit, you may wonder. I went to see the show twice in 2 days, first sitting on a banquette on stage and returning to sit in the orchestra. For those who want to be closest to the action, the stage might be the place to be. For fans of Mr. Groban, perhaps the orchestra is the best choice. Then again, I had a friend who saw it from the mezzanine and he felt he had an ideal view. The answer really is, with a show this intoxicatingly good, there's probably no such thing as a bum seat.
And you know, I want to talk about that review because he loved the show. They must have been so happy to get this review because he basically said he liked it better than Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was very interesting is that he does mention that he saw it multiple times in different locations, which for me, like, I ended up seeing it I guess I saw it 3 times. And the first time I saw it, I was like, all right, that's pretty good. Like, I sort of had my reservations about it, but I was like, I want to see it. The first time I saw it, I was in the mezzanine, and I was like, I want to see it from the onstage seats just to, you know, see what it's like. And that was really what won me over. Like, and the second time I saw it, I liked it so much more. So I think there's just like so much stuff going on. Like, it was just such an incredible, just the way it was staged, the way the theater was knocked down and reconstructed. You had these like little moments of intimacy with like the different actors because they're all over the place. They're all in these different corners. I had never had an experience like it.
Totally. And I think that there is something to be said for that and like the inventiveness of that. I also think that like while we're at this point in time in the past 20 years where people are on their phones, cell phones during a show, like in a situation like this, it's impossible to be. As a viewer, you're transformed by being incorporated into the action of the show.
Definitely. It was the most nominated show this season, but it only ended up taking home 2, which were Best Lighting and Best Set Design, which were the same 2. We mentioned this in the Sunday in the Park with George episode, but that was also what happened with Sunday in the Park with George. And Mimi Lien, who was the set designer, she also had just won a MacArthur Genius Grant, partially from her work on this show. And also, I think she had one of the best looks of the evening at Tony Night.
Yes.
She was wearing this gold, sparkly, like deep V-neck, but it had sort of like bars across the chest. She was killing it.
Yeah, like how pissed off would you have been if like Evan Hansen or like Come From Away won Best Scenic Design?
I guess that's true. That's like one area where it's like, it's just not even debatable.
Yeah, it was really clear. Like, I mean, in both situations, and I feel like the scenic design and the direction are so intertwined. I think that is like another thing that makes it so cool about Dave Malloy having been in the show at certain points. It feels really cool that the author was like involved with all of this. And like, I think that it feels really true to like what I think his vision maybe.
I just want to pause and say that Come From Away and Evan Hansen were not nominated for Best Scenic Design. It was Grey Comet, Groundhog Day, War Paint, and Hello Dolly, which I think is a little bit more of a tough race, but it's still no question. There's this anecdote that he tells that kind of reminded me of, you know, when they were talking about creating the original production of Cabaret, when Joel Grey, like, or I don't remember if it was Joel Grey, it was someone who was in sort of like a seedy Berlin cabaret, and they saw like the MC. Dave Malloy had the idea to make it in sort of this nightclub environment when he went to Russia. And he went to this bar with live music and they had shakers and everyone was like eating dumplings and drinking vodka. And he was like, this is kind of the vibe, the ambiance that I want for this show. I think this show kind of shares some DNA with Dear Evan Hansen, where it's like surrounding this kind of depressed protagonist who's, you know, searching for meaning in his life. Although I think Pierre's problems are like a little bit more existential. Mm-hmm. But they had this quote, I think this was in an article about the closing. In more recent months, the show has drawn a younger fan base, many who, like Malloy, strongly identify with a depressive, introverted character like Pierre. It's been really cool to kind of reach this younger generation who's struggling with some of these issues and feel like they're being seen, Malloy says. Like, I think with something like Dear Evan Hansen, it's like, oh, you're a depressed teenager in high school and you relate to a depressed teenager in high school. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, have a little imagination. Like, maybe relate to like a depressed Russian aristocrat from the 19th century, you know?
I feel like it has the elements that really drew me to theater in it. I think that it's young and sexy in a way that Dear Evan Hansen isn't, but also not too racy. It's like young and sexy without being racy.
And something that I thought was shocking was that this show has an amazing female supporting cast and they were all snubbed for Tonys. Like the only acting Tony nominations were Danae Benton, Josh Groban, and Lucas Steele. Maybe they all split the votes, but it just seems wild to me that none of them got nominated.
I remember my favorite part of the show was Sonia's solo at the top of Act 2.
Oh, I will stand in the dark for you. I will hold you back by force.
Yeah, and you have Amber Gray having like a show-stopping moment.
How she blushes, how she blushes, my pretty Shantae.
MacLane.
It's lucky for him he escaped, but I'll find him. Now you listen to me when I speak to you. Now you listen to me when I speak to you! In my house, do you hear what I'm saying or not?
Like, there's just so much, who ended up winning supporting actress? Oh, Rachel Bay Jones. So I don't know if they would have, one of them would have taken it if they had gotten nominated.
I also think that in a show like this, maybe it's sort of like hard to stand out.
Yeah.
This is like also notable because there are some people that really, you know, it elevated them to stardom. I mean, in the original Ars Nova production, you have Philippa Sue, who went on to be in Hamilton and then be Amelie.
Actually, I feel like this show sort of showed in multiple ways that being in Hamilton was not the ticket to stardom that everyone thought it would be, because you have Amelie closing and then you have this other controversy, which we'll get to in a moment. I think this season just definitively showed that just being in Hamilton is not enough to make you, to give you the star power to keep a show open.
I guess I like wonder, was Josh Groban the right? I didn't see Groban, so no, I mean, he does have a beautiful voice, but something that I think Jesse Green mentioned in the original review and something that I also think is that there's like definitely like an emo element to it.
Yeah.
So it's like, why not get Pete Wentz?
I have a couple things to say about that. Number one, I agree that I think Josh Groban's voice type is not really the type you would think for this material. And it's very, very different from Dave Malloy, who does have that kind of whiny, raspy, like emo boy voice. But Josh Groban was selling the show. The show was doing great while he was in it. It was just every time he was out of it, the numbers would drop a lot, which I think was also part of the problem, his casting, because even though it was selling, I feel like his fan base were not necessarily like the overlap between his fans and the type of people who would enjoy a show like this is like not as big as you would want it to be. Like, I think it was attracting his fans, but they weren't necessarily enjoying it. It's also like not really a huge role for him, even though it's in the title.
Yeah, it's true. He just kind of like sits on stage the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like his fans would like love to see him in Les Mis.
Yeah, exactly. Like, do we want to get into the dramas, or do you have anything else you want to talk about the show itself?
Well, one thing I do want to mention is that I think that in theory, it's cool that the score makes use of like such different types of music, but it still has this Slavic music hall element that kind of connects a lot of it. I don't know. I just like really, I think the lyrics are not good.
I mean, I definitely don't like the use of the third person Tolstoy narration in it. That part of it doesn't work for me.
I've been trying all week to like put my finger on what I don't like about it. You know, I don't hate it. I would gladly see it tomorrow. I think that like it's a little impenetrable. I think that there just might be a little bit too much going on for me.
That's fair. I mean, I enjoyed going to see it. I definitely would have gone to see it, you know, a few more times if it had stayed open, but like I've never really had, besides like a couple of songs, I've never really had the urge to revisit it on the album.
There was this thing on PBS in the late 90s called Barrage that was sort of like, they were this band who were modern world beat ensemble. It was just like high energy violin music that like blended Celtic and swing and bluegrass and, you know, all types of world music. And I can't not think of that when I think of this.
I mean, I think there's elements of like, you know, Gogo Bordello or even like maybe the Dresden Dolls, a little bit DNA in there. Like, I think there's sort of these punk cabaret fusion influences that there's something like a little extra about them. But like, yeah. I feel like what's fun about this show is it is just super extra and it just kind of leans into it.
Like, I think out of all the performances of the best musical nominees that night, it was a really insane thing to see everyone like crazy dances in the audience.
Yeah, I thought their performance was great.
Yeah, I remember thinking at the time, I'm like, oh, they're going to get it.
Okay, I guess we should get into the sad portion of this. The first drama came before it even opened on Broadway and was relatively minor, but basically the lead producers, I think, were just doing a lot of shady stuff the whole time. Like, I think that's kind of the overarching theme of this. First of all, Ars Nova sued them because they didn't want to put the Ars Nova production of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 in the program, which was what they had contractually agreed to. And then eventually they backed down and it seemed like that was fine. But the real issue, which I think we're not going to go into too much. There are a few very detailed articles written on it that we'll have in our show notes if you want to dig into it. But basically what happened was, okay, so Josh Groban was getting ready to leave the show. And 5 months in advance, after the Tony nominations were announced, but before the Tonys happened, they announced that the actor who played Hercules Mulligan in Hamilton, Akiyete Onadwon, also known as Oak, was going to take over the role of Pierre. And he is, I believe he's Nigerian-American. So everyone was like, okay, cool. You know, and this is kind of like a bet, as we mentioned before, seeing, you know, he's like the eighth lead in Hamilton, like seeing if that is enough to keep the show going. And he was supposed to go on for an 8-week run. And then right before he was about to start, he tweeted that they were pushing his start date back by a week because the show wasn't ready. And then later it came out it was because he wasn't ready because he has to, you know, play the piano and accordion. So then after the Tonys happened and the show didn't really win anything major, they, you know, realized they had to do damage control. And they approached Mandy Patinkin, who was a fan of the show, and he agreed to go in. But because of his shooting schedule, he was only available during the last 3 weeks of Oak's run. So they put out an announcement that, you know, he was coming in, he was going to replace Oak. And there was this huge backlash because to a lot of people, it symbolized the way that Black actors are kind of marginalized and not supported on Broadway, which is, you know, a real issue. And so there was this huge social media backlash. Mandy pulled out of the show, Oak refused to come back to the show, and basically no one would touch it. They said that the music team was working with an unnamed TV star who, you know, the buzz was that it was Rainn Wilson from The Office to come in after that run, but then no one, you know, it was just like toxic after that. And then they announced that the show was closing, which is sad because it had one of the most diverse casts, I think the most diverse cast of all the Best Musical nominees. Mm-hmm. You know, it had fully colorblind casting, like the female lead, you know, a Russian princess was played by Danae Benton, who's Black. It's a very complicated and just kind of a bummer all around.
Yeah,
that it had to go down that way.
It just sucked. I think from this, people on Broadway learned a lot and reflected on their own behavior.
It's complicated and it's sad because it's like, feels like there are people who are like, you know, the Twitter mob just likes to get outraged over everything without, you know, knowing the situation. And it's like, no, you know, it's good that people are calling attention to these issues. It's just that the situation was like not what it appeared to be. You know, it was about financial realities of Broadway and about having to bring in a bankable name that mm-hmm. happened to be a white actor replacing a Black one.
Yeah.
And earlier in the summer, they had had Ingrid Michaelson come in and replace one of the cast members who'd been there from the beginning. So it's like the show had already been trying to do this, trying to keep itself afloat. The one sort of coda of that is that the financials of the whole thing weren't really adding up because the show was selling really well when Josh Groban was there. Like, how could it possibly be in such financial trouble that like him being out for a month was enough to close it? So a group of co-producers, I don't know if this they ended up doing it, but the end of that article says that the co-producers are planning to try to audit the production because Mr. Kagan, who was the lead producer, has returned 15% of the capitalization to investors, and he was unusually reluctant to share financial information, and that the weekly running costs are unclear. So it seems like there was a little bit of financial, a little bit of shady bookkeeping going on to compound the issue.
Eek.
Yeah.
Not surprising, though.
Yeah.
Here's to happiness, freedom, and life. May your travels be swift as a scythe come through the grass. May your sorrows be counted in number as many as drops of wine and vodka that stay in my glass. Sibo Haroshima, Namosa Shoppa Ekali. Sibo Haroshima, Namosa Shoppa Ekali. Sibo Haroshima, Namosa
Okay, so Groundhog Day is our last Best Musical nominee.
And this, out of anything, really got the shitty end of the stick. Groundhog Day opened April 17th, 2017, and it closed on September 17th, 2017. After 176 performances, you have a book by Danny Rubin and music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, directed by Matthew Warchus, choreographed by Peter Darling and Ellen Kane, and it was based on the 1993 fantasy comedy film directed by Harold Ramis, starring Bill Murray. How would you spend your time if forced to repeat the same day over and over again? Phil Connors, a seasoned big city weatherman, is frustrated to be reporting the annual Groundhog Day ceremony in a small town, Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. His arrogance and cynicism are in direct opposition to the cheery townsfolk who are ready for their favorite groundhog to not see his shadow and welcome an early spring. After disdainfully covering the rodent's negative forecast, he awakens the next day only to discover it's February 2nd once more. Initially in disbelief, Phil finally accepts he is doomed to repeat the same day over and over again.
You know, this is one that I'm sad about. I saw this and I thought it was very fun. I think it was one of the better movie to musical adaptations. The book writer was the writer of the film screenplay, and then Tim Minchin and Matthew Warchus were also behind Matilda, which also I thought was very good. But I guess I couldn't do it.
I feel like it was surprisingly unflashy. When I imagine what it was going to be like in my head, I was like, oh, this is going to be horrible and like filled with like bad dad jokes and like groaners, but it really wasn't. I thought they did a really good job of adapting it, but I just don't think that means it's going to appeal to a wider audience.
No, or just that, you know, there was so much other competition this season that it just kind of slipped through the cracks. I feel like somebody like slipped Ben Brantley a Valium this season or something, because the review for this and the review for Come From Away were both like, I thought I was going to hate this show, but it was actually pretty good. He called it dizzyingly witty. He said, it is cool as in hip and warm as in cuddly. It is spiky and sentimental, and it transforms its perceived weaknesses into strengths in ways that should disarm even veteran musical haters. I mean, that's like it's a strong review. That's some good pull quotes. Going back to sort of the history of making Groundhog Day into a musical, you know, infamously Sondheim talked about how much he loves the movie and that he was interested in adapting it. And I think he sort of toyed around with it. And then he said a few years later that, you know, it's just perfect as it is and it can't be improved, which is something that I appreciate about him, is that he knows what's what. Like, he knows what can and can't be improved by being turned into a musical.
I think that that's a good jumping off point, because I didn't necessarily love listening to the cast recording. I did like watching the bootleg, mm-hmm. and I was trying to imagine like what other type of music could be written for this, or like, you know, if there was any other sound, but this kind of light rock poppy,
right,
this like subtle score really did it justice without making it seem like, I feel like a bad instinct would be like, oh, this is like a really silly hick small town, we're gonna make it sound like Lil Abner or something.
Right. I pulled a quote from the New Yorker review of the show talking about the original movie that I thought was really nice. Groundhog Day goes deeper than its elevator pitch suggests. Its structure allowed for endless comedic variations on a theme. Say, trying to come up with the perfect pickup line when you have infinite tries that show off Murray's improvisatory genius. The film is a romantic comedy, a fish-out-of-water story, and a carpe diem morality tale reminiscent of Our Town and A Christmas Carol. Beyond that, it's also a spiritual brain teaser. The screenwriter, Danny Rubin, has said that Phil goes through phases akin to the Kubler-Ross stages of grief. Bewilderment, hedonism, suicide, self-improvement, altruism. Is he in purgatory? Has time become stuck, or has Phil's consciousness become unstuck? And how long does he spend in February 2nd? Based on the amount of time it takes Phil to master the piano and ice sculpting, the website What Culture once estimated that he endured 12,395 days, or about 34 years. Rubin thinks it was at least a lifetime. Ramis guessed 10 years. The studio thought it was 2 weeks. So I think this material has a lot more depth than something like Tootsie or like Mrs. Doubtfire, where it's like, let's take a nostalgic classic and turn it into a musical. Like, it has a lot to say about, you know, philosophy and human nature. And I think like it does really suit itself to be adapted into a musical where those things can be, you know, it has like a real emotional weight to it.
No, totally. I think part of why I am surprised it didn't do so well is because it's like so popular. Thinking of something like Bridges of Madison County, where it's like, oh, this was at one time really popular, but people don't really care about it. I think that people probably also had a lot of judgments about it.
Yeah. And I also think that like it's so identified with Bill Murray, and they kind of went a different way with casting Andy Carl, even though, which I think was smart that they didn't do someone who's trying to do a Bill Murray impression. But like, I think the average person who's going to buy a ticket to the Groundhog Day musical is going to be like, well, this guy isn't like Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But I mean, he got great reviews. I think he was the only one who was really going to give Ben Platt a run for his money. And there was some real drama where he, 3 days before opening night, he tore his ACL on stage. And like, tearing your ACL is something that if you're an athlete, you're like out for the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. I assume. I don't, yeah. That's what I've heard. I don't really know that much about sports, but like, he finished the show and then he was back in for opening night because otherwise he wouldn't be eligible for the Tony. It's an incredible story, and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, no, that is amazing.
And he's taken a lot of bad breaks. Like, you know, he was in the Rocky musical that also flopped badly. I mean, I guess he did finally get a hit with Pretty Woman, but like, at what cost, you know?
Yeah, talking about things that should be left as they are.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think this is so much better than Pretty Woman. You know, it deserved to live. But I think they also made a mistake with the song that they performed. Like, this was a very strange choice.
I've spent a lifetime seeking signs, reading lines, trying to forecast the future. Always staying a day ahead. Well, that was the idea, but I'm here.
What would you have recommended that they performed?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe it was just technical requirements because the show had 5 turntables and maybe it would have been too hard to restage some of the more complicated songs. But I think If I Had My Time Again from Act 2 would have been the mm-hmm. obvious choice for me.
If I had my time again, the things I'd handle better, I would send my unsent letters.
I have started 700 fights, and if you knew the endless nights that I have wasted getting wasted, contemplating different ways to suicide.
I've tried and I've tried.
And I've tried every food and every drink and every cheat and every choice 1,000 times.
Enjoy to other people's
and I daily
lives.
Eat about 12 donuts and I don't know why.
And I
don't
I
know.
I would learn piano.
Why?
And I would make a lot of friends if I had my time.
Also, I wonder if it opening so late in the season kind of affected its chances. You know, it opened April 17th, which is not necessarily sneaking right in there, but I feel like, you know, if it had opened in the fall, I wonder if it would have built its audience.
Yeah, or even if it had waited for next season. What was next season? Oh, The Band's Visit. I feel like it would have given The Band's Visit a
run
for
its
maybe.
Money. Yeah. But it, against SpongeBob, 2 adaptations that people would be like, well, that's not a real sponge.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you put it next to SpongeBob, I mean, we both obviously liked SpongeBob a lot, but I think people's perception of SpongeBob, it was like, I think Groundhog Day would look like, you know, Sondheim.
Yeah.
So it closed pretty quickly. And it also, you know, it was very well received in London, which was where it opened first.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy Carl won the Olivier. Oh, and towards the end of the run, Bill Murray came to the show twice in 1 week and sort of drummed up some publicity. And apparently they reported that by the end of the show, he was visibly sobbing.
Yeah, I think that it makes sense to me that it probably did a little better in London than it did on Broadway, because I feel like it probably doesn't occupy the same space and culture there
right.
as it does here.
It doesn't have the baggage.
Yeah. of being shown on Comedy Central like six times a month.
But you know what's kind of interesting is like the fate of the show, the post-Broadway fate is kind of in limbo, because after closing both Grey Comet and this announced tours that did not happen, but at least Grey Comet had the like a Tokyo production. This has not been produced at all since. And I saw it's been licensed by like it's available for a license from MTI, but it says it's limited and there are no productions coming up anywhere in the country. So I don't know if what's going on. Like, I guess I understand why it didn't tour, because it was, you know, the set was so complicated. But like, I feel like this would be very popular to do regionally if they were allowed to.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree.
Let the people do Groundhog Day. What's going on, MTI? I don't know. Maybe they're like, maybe they are going to get the tour together. I don't know. But although listening to the cast recording, I was like, this one's probably too dirty for high schools. But
yeah,
it has a it has a big cast. And I saw the New York Times did a cute article about the 21 actors in the ensemble have 300 costume changes throughout the course of the show.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's pretty wild. So RIP Groundhog Day. You deserved better. Sorry, you're in limbo. But it seems fitting for what you're all about. Oh, and also, I think it was a bad sign that, you know, they had, what is his name? Kevin Spacey in his Johnny Carson impression introducing Groundhog Day. Like, they couldn't get freaking Andy McDowell up there or something.
Yeah.
You know, like, was Chris Elliott busy?
Ugh. Yeah, and he also makes note of the Andy Carl tear in his opening monologue. I think
he switches the Evan Hansen cast from his arm to his leg. Some real inside baseball.
Oh brother.
Should we do some quick hits?
Yeah.
So some of the other shows, we talked a little about Amelie. So Anastasia didn't perform, but it did end up making a run for it. It ran for, I want to say almost 3 years. Yeah, it ran 3 years on the dot, pretty much, if you count previews, which is pretty good for mixed reviews. And I, you know, obviously as a child of the 90s, I loved this movie, but after reading that Romanov's book a few years ago, like the one, I think it's called Nicholas and Alexandra, like the 600-page one, which, side note, after reading that, I would try to, for like a full month, anytime someone would try to talk to me, I would somehow like find a way to link the conversation to Rasputin, which nobody liked. But I just think this is such an incredibly tasteless story to try to adapt into like a feel-good family musical. Like, it's literally about a child getting murdered in a basement with her family, and it's like, wait a minute, what if she didn't? And like, I know that there were, you know, real life people who pretended to be Anastasia, but I think that this taking sort of this tone and this kind of like, oh my God, she was an orphan and now she's a real life princess. It's like, that's totally missing the point of this story.
Yeah. And it makes, you know, this was a 20th Century Fox property that they produced the 1956 movie, which Arthur Lawrence wrote the screenplay for.
It's so wild.
I'm surprised that I had never learned that. But yeah, it was like apparently adapted from that and the 1997 animated movie, which I think we can all say was more of where the basis of it came from.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I don't think I realized before it made its Broadway turn that Flaherty and Ahrens wrote the music. Mm-hmm. And you pointed this out earlier, but the Terrence McNally book, it's like, wow.
Yeah, a little ragtime reunion there.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like I sort of appreciate that they in at the adaptation, it seems like they tried to make it a little more historically accurate than like, you know, the talking bat in the movie. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it had its fans for sure.
I don't know. It's funny to see, you know, and I feel like this is happening more and more with, I feel like, all these other big film producing units are trying to do the Disney treatment to their properties. And
this is one of the ultimate movies that like people think is a Disney movie, but it's not. Like, they were really trying to bite the Disney princess, bite off a little piece of that pie.
Especially in 1997 when Disney trying to figure it out.
I mean, I think in terms of, like tasteless historical adaptations, like, I think Pocahontas is really number one in this category, but I think this one is, like, right under it, you know, thinking about the real story versus what is happening in the show. You know what I will say? Once Upon a December and Journey to the Past are both bangers, and I found out that Journey to the Past lost the Oscar to My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, but Aaliyah performed it on the Oscars.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah.
One step at a time, one hope, then another. Who knows where this road may go?
So we also had War Paint. I think that's the only other one we should talk about, right?
Yeah.
In terms of musicals.
Which had a pretty short run that was apparently cut short for a reason we'll get into. But it opened on April 6th, 2017, closed November 5th after 236 performances. Music by Scott Frankel, book by Doug Wright, and lyrics by Michael Corey. It was directed by Michael Greif, who also directed Dear Evan Hansen. And Mark Platt, Mr. Ben Platt's father, was one of the producers.
Maybe he was trying to sow some, plant some flops in there.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this was really, it's interesting because like watching the theater talk, like Michael Rydell is like, this is like the show I'm most excited for this season. Like I saw it in Chicago and it was great. And I feel like there was like a lot of fanfare about it coming to Broadway, but I don't feel like it really even made much of a splash.
No. And like, I'm a, you know, big fan of Patti LuPone, big fan of Christine Ebersole. This, it just seemed devastatingly boring.
Yeah.
And I don't think that song that they performed really did anything to, dispel that impression.
Yeah, it's about, they play Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein, who are rival 20th century makeup entrepreneurs. And like, it just kind of seems like their stories don't, reading pieces about kind of like the show and the making of it, like they never really crossed paths that much in life. And like, instead of taking some creative justice, or taking a lot, you know, I think in the musical, they kind of like weave it together. But like, it's kind of like, is this musical about Elizabeth Arden or is it about Helena Rubinstein? Like, I think that kind of doing, having like two big divas who demand a lot of stage play, dueling divas, is not the right way to go with it.
Yeah. And I also think that like a business rivalry is not dramatically interesting enough for a 2.5 hour musical.
Yeah.
Unless someone is like getting murdered, you know?
Yeah, no, it's just like they were both very successful women.
And this performance is pretty much what I imagined it to be, which is like them both singing in their offices to like out to the audience. Although Christine Ebersole does say the name of the show in the song, which I always appreciate.
Reveal what's real beneath the war paint.
The funniest thing for me was that, you know, the song is called Face to Face, but Christine Ebersole is like a full head taller than Patti LuPone. So like when they turn to face each other, they're just like you guys are not face to face. Patti's face to face with your collarbone.
You know, these, the creative team, they had worked with Christine on the Grey Gardens musical, which I think was, you know, I got really into at the time, but I think that this as like a follow-up just like feels a little weak and like it feels a little gay baity. They're like, well, all the gays love Christine Ebersole, I bet they'll love Patti LuPone too.
That's not enough. You can't just, you know, have two divas and not give them something juicy to do.
But something I was really surprised about is that it recouped its original $11 million investment.
What?
Yeah.
That's the opposite of Natasha, Pierre, etc. Some smart bookkeeping, not shady bookkeeping.
Yeah, that like really surprised me. I didn't see it. I do remember overhearing someone in the theater district be like, oh yeah, I saw War Paint 3 times. And they also had one of those big TV screen monitor advertisements. But that's all I really remember about it. It's very difficult to listen to the score.
I remember even being like, Patty being like, this is going to be my last leading role on Broadway was not enough to get me in there. I was like, meh.
But originally the closing date of December 30th, 2017 was announced, but they closed almost 2 months earlier because Patty had to have hip replacement surgery.
Well, I'm glad she's up and at 'em again.
Yeah.
And I am going to see her in Company. So take that, War Paint. You tried to lure me in. I know she's supporting now.
The one really sweet thing about it, I feel like they really try to sell it in like interviews I've seen them give. And like, it seems like they got along really well. So
yeah, I mean, it is nice to see, like, you don't really often see a musical that has 2 lead roles for a woman of a certain age, but it's like, make it not boring.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like with this and the Grey Gardens musical, they're like, what do Broadway audiences like? They like divas and they like women of a certain age.
You know, they're not wrong.
Yeah.
As we are.
Do you want to do Tim's Play Corner?
Yeah, let's do it. So in the actual ceremony, they do say, they make note of this, that all of the plays nominated for Best Play this year were American, which
is unusual.
Yeah, so that is cool. And it's also like a pretty good smattering of different types of styles. Oslo won Best Play. It was written by J.T. Rogers. And it tells the story of the husband and wife who were Norwegian diplomats who organized the peace negotiations between the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and the Palestine Liberation Organization chairman Yasser Arafat in 1993. And the play is like 3 hours long, and I think it's just like a lot of talking, but you know,
people loved it.
Yeah, people loved it.
I feel like to me it's the least interesting out of all of these plays, as someone who did not see any of them, just like concept alone. But, you know, I admire anyone who's able to take something that seems like a really sort of dry, like, political situation and makes it riveting enough for people to want to sit through 3 hours of it and also to win the Tony.
I like have no interest in it, but I was actually surprised because I was like, how did it win? But it seemed like people really were into it. And then I did see 2 of the plays that were nominated for Best Play. Indecent, it opened April 18th, closed August 6th, and it was written by Paula Vogel. Indecent tells the story of Sholom Asch's controversial play, The God of Vengeance, and the passionate artist who risked everything to bring it to the stage. So it's about this like Yiddish play that is being
about lesbians.
Yeah, about lesbians that travels around the world at the turn of the century. And it's probably the most like heart, or it was like the play that affected me the most that I can say that I've seen in recent years. It's really beautifully done. It's really poetic. There's music woven in the play itself. It was, as I said, written by Paula Vogel, but it kind of had like an interesting genesis where one of Paula Vogel's graduate students, or 2 of them, Rebecca Rugg and Rebecca Teichman, developed it as like part of a documentary theater history piece. And from that, Paula Vogel kind of like adapted it into a play. And Rebecca Teichman ended up directing it and winning a Tony for her.
Yeah,
direction.
I feel like that was also a big upset. Like, no one was expecting her to win that.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy for her.
Like, in the same way, Natasha and Pierre, you can like look at something and be like, oh, an artist like crafted this. I think that this feels the same with Indecent, where it's like so choreographed. It's like so poetic and moving. And there's a PBS Great Performances recording of it that I highly recommend you watching.
I want to watch it. I did not get around to doing it for this one, but I would have if it had won Best Play.
Yeah.
And side note, if you go to Paula Vogel's Twitter, she personally wishes good luck to every regional theater that's putting on Indecent, which I think is very sweet.
Aw, yeah, no, it's really gotten, you know, it's being performed a lot. I think that, like, in this contemporary moment, it, like, makes sense that artists across the country would, like, find comfort and meaning in this, like, story of these people who suffered great adversity and were able to
rise up.
Yeah, rise, not rise above, but rise up, yeah. And also, it was my introduction to Katrina Link.
Hell yeah. Gonna co-star with Patty. It all comes full circle.
Yes. And then Sweat by Lynn Nottage won the Pulitzer Prize that year. It ran over 100, just barely over 100 performances. And it's also, well, I guess not also, but it's like a documentary style play where she went to this town of Reading, Pennsylvania, which is where I used to go outlet shopping when I was growing up. It's like about the steelworkers in that town and the conflicts in the community and kind of these people who are working and living in some place that has been devastated by the close of like a steel mill. And she spent a lot of time in Reading, like interviewing people, and so many. There's like an interview that she gave for Al Jazeera where she was like, it was amazing to perform this at Reading, and like, you know, in the same way that Come From Away, you know, the people mm-hmm. who the characters were based on got to see the play. They were like, you're telling my story. Thank you. You know, I've seen some of her other plays, and I think that it really speaks to like her as an artist that she's able to do something like this and also do something like, by the way, Meet Vera Stark, which is not light, but like kind of like a fun romp.
Yeah.
And then the last play that was nominated for Best Play was A Doll's House Part 2, which I also saw, and that ran 172 performances. It was written by Lucas Hanoff, directed by Sam Gold. As its title suggests, it is the unofficial sequel to Ibsen's A Dollhouse, where Nora comes back and kind of like sees what happened since she slammed the door at the end of A Doll's House. And it's another talky play. It starred Laurie Metcalf, who, it's talky, but it is very entertaining and very just good theater. And it also had like an amazing cast. Laurie Metcalf won Best Actress in a Play for it. You got Jane Hodishell, Condola Rashad.
When they cut to Condola Rashad for her nomination, I gasped because she looked so beautiful. I just need to shout out. She really brought it that night and always.
Yeah. It's cool that she's in this like theater family lineage. She has a theater family lineage.
Yeah.
We haven't had a chance to talk about Felicia yet, but we'll get there.
I know.
What, something fun that I saw is that there had been 13 revivals or 13 productions of A Doll's House on Broadway.
Wow. Yeah. That's wild.
It is. And there hasn't been one since like 1995. So.
Wow. That's like that Sherlock Holmes play that they kept reviving.
So it was a good year for plays.
Yeah, I'm like very impressed with the diversity of author and content that was in this category. And I thought they did a nice job of, like, I always like when they let the playwright introduce the play.
Oh, yeah, no, you know? That's so great. It also was just like, oh, well, now I know what it's about. And also, all of these playwrights are so, have such good charisma.
Yeah, great category.
Also, another thing to note in the plays is that August Wilson got some recognition. Jitney won Best Revival of a Play.
The interesting thing about that is that it was actually the first time, and the producer actually mentions that in the speech, but she's getting played off. But, you know, he had written these this decade cycle of plays, which were 10 plays all set in different decades, and Jitney was the only one that hadn't been produced on Broadway, but they decided to classify it as a revival because it was so, you know, commonly produced in regional theaters and whatever, because sometimes they do that. Mm-hmm. So sort of in that weird space where it's not a revival, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
So, but they got it up there.
Mm-hmm. The only other thing that I feel like I need to say is that in that piece, that kind of like the Tony prediction piece that we talked about in the first episode, the author at the end like kind of makes mention, like, you know what I really miss? Like the special event category. And I think that if I had something that would win Best Special Event, it would be Oh Hello on Broadway.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Oh, do you have a dream threesome? Speaking of the two of them presenting together.
There was a lot of onesomes presenting in this.
But I thought the twosomes they presented were all very good. It was hard to pick.
I think it Tom Sterling and Olivia Wilde.
Oh, yeah. Tom Sturridge.
Yes, Tom Sturridge. Yes.
So they were in that production of 1984 that it wasn't eligible, but that was the one that had people like throwing up and passing out and whatever. Mine would be a tie either Allison Janney and Chris Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Or Sarah Bareilles and pregnant Patina Miller. Oh, and you know, when Patina Miller came out, I was like, where's Patina Miller been? And the answer is always Madam Secretary. like if you're like, where's this Broadway person been? They're always on some show that I'm not really paying attention to.
Yes. The last two items I'll mention is that this was the season of the play That Goes Wrong, and that had a crazy run for a play, 737 performances. So good job to them.
Isn't it still running? Didn't they transfer it off Broadway? Yeah, it's playing at New World Stages. So they did the classic move of, you know, Avenue Q, Jersey Boys.
Mm-hmm. Good for them.
I mean, everyone wants like a noises off, you know, situation.
Yeah.
That's like really a formula that people respond to.
Yeah.
And I believe it's on tour right now also. Wow, it's on a big tour. And then Patti LuPone and Kevin Spacey come out and sing a Bobby Darin song at the end.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls.
Oh, and also he comes out as his stupid House of Cards character then with Robin Wright. And Robin Wright does not get to say one word. It's like, I would rather have had Robin Wright host this than you. Don't make her come out here and not let her say anything. Oh, and I thought Tina Fey got a good zinger in when she was introducing leading actor in a musical.
Straight men playing gay. Gay men playing straight. Anxiety disorders, existential crises, accordions, and fat suits. These are just a few of my college dating experiences.
All right, so our next episode is going to be the last one. We're finishing another decade cycle, just like August Wilson.
Yes.
Our decade cycle is finishing. So speaking of Patina Miller, sort of, our next year we're going to do is a 1973, which was Pippin, but was also A Little Night Music. Yeah, so that one's going to be a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
This is another one where only one of the Best Musical nominees performed. Only Pippin performed, and then they had like a bunch of random performances.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at My Little Tonies. You can email us at MyLittleToniesPodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. It makes us happy to hear from you. It makes us happy to get nice reviews because, you know, we're kind of doing this in our little echo chamber, so it's nice to hear from people who are enjoying it.
Yes, everything she just said is true.
So thank you for listening, and we will see you in the 70s.
Yes, goodbye.
Bye.
If we had this to do again,